March 10, 2013, in Lanesia, Johannesburg, South Africa.
Today is Shivaratri, and I thought we'd do a little meditation on Lord Shiva as the greatest Vaishnava. Of course, we have Bhagavatamrita. There's so many greater and greater and greater and greater and greater Vaishnavas, but still, Shiva is called the greatest of the Vaishnavas.
Shiva is not different from Krishna, but it is added with this material energy. Therefore, Shiva is turned into Jiva. Just samudana pitaha samudai pitaja bhurindamani purdam. But somebody is required for distraction. So that distraction part is taken by Shiva.
So in this material world, we have creation, maintenance, and destruction. In the spiritual world, there's always existence. There's no creation and destruction. This world constantly creating, destroying, creating, destroying. So this destruction is done by this guna avatar of the Lord as Shiva. He's in charge of ignorance. He's in charge of ignorance, madness, intoxication, anything that causes destruction and dissolution. So it's quite interesting, you know, in the Christian tradition, and I think also in the Muslim tradition, they have a concept of a devil. Yes? And they have this devil almost like a second god. He's like a competitor. And the devil is responsible for all the pain and suffering and all the destruction, and somehow God can't seem to do anything about it. Someday he'll do something about it. That's the end of their idea. You know, they have a very concocted philosophy. It's not actually in their scriptures, but they make up this philosophy that someday Jesus will come back and then he'll throw the devil in the ocean of fire, and then that will be the end of all suffering. So it's quite interesting, because if you read the descriptions of the devil, you find that they have a lot in common with Shiva. Right? That he has a trident, that he has ghosts and demons and hobgoblins as his associates. But in the Vedic understanding, we see that Shiva is a devotee. Not only a devotee, he's the qualitative expansion of the Lord. He's not a living entity like you or I. And he's not some second god who's in opposition to God, but rather he's a servant. And he's doing the work of destruction within the universe when following the order of Krishna. And in line with one's karma and one's destiny and one's due, not just sort of some random evil person. So in the Vedas, we're able to integrate this concept of good and evil. Shiva himself is not evil. Shiva means all auspicious. He's all good. Just like a person in a government who's running the prison department, that person, hopefully at least, is not a criminal. Nowadays, you never know. The idea is that that person is not a criminal. I just want to look at Lord Shiva's qualities. And this is a quote from the Vihad Bhagavatamrita. Now, the reason that is the bones are glorious is that they're from the bodies of Vaishnavas who've passed. They're what we call relics. So anything from the Vaishnava is very glorious. Now, though his body's fair like camphor, often he's shown as bluish or dark, but that's because he smears his body with crematorium ashes. He's actually golden or very light color. And he's absorbed in renunciation. Lord Shiva's mood is that of complete renunciation and detachment. So he's the master of everything, and of course his wife is the illusory energy, but he's not interested in material opulence. He lives under a tree, with just skin that he's wearing. You know, he doesn't. At one point, actually, he built a house, and then he gave the house away in charity at the house opening ceremony. He didn't have anything else to give, so he gave the house. Have a house. And it's described that his wife wears the jewelry given by her father because she didn't get any jewelry from her husband. So his mood is that of detachment. We'll get into that a little bit later. And he has, again, the material energy is his consort. So Krishna himself doesn't consort with the material energy. Krishna's consort is a spiritual energy, Ladini Shakti, Srimati Radharani, Lakshmi Devi, so forth, Sri Gunila, the various potencies of the internal energy. Krishna is not interested in enjoying the external energy. But in the form of Shiva, he enjoys the external energy. Of course, he has wonderful associates like Kartikeya and Nandishwar and Ganesh, and then of course he has ghastly associates also. Somebody has to take care of the ghastly people. It's basically what it comes down to. You know, we had one devotee, and now he's retired, but he was a medical doctor, and part of his job, what he was the medical doctor at the maximum security prison for the criminally insane. Somebody has to take care. Just because somebody is criminally insane doesn't mean that they don't receive any care from the government. They may have to be locked up in maximum security prison. So, you know, I write for Bhakti Godhead, and sometimes we have devotees who do prison preaching, and they sometimes get our Bhakti Godheads into prisons. So I was getting these letters from this one person, they were very odd letters. It was somebody who was in one of these maximum security prisons for the criminally insane. So once I found that out, I was a little nervous. You know, I contacted the prison. They said, "Don't worry, lady, this man's never getting out." But still, they're taken care of. That's my point. Taken care of. So, in the universe, everyone is taken care of. Even demons are taken care of. Like Jesus said, that we should love our enemies. He said, just like God, he sends the sun on the just and the unjust. The sun and the rain, it's not that the sun and the rain only come to the pious people. The most criminal and the most evil people, they still get sunshine, they still get rain. So there's someone to take care of them. And Lord Shiva is not only just taking care of them, but his purpose is to elevate them, because he's a great Vaishnava. By his association, they can become elevated. If they become attached to him, then they can become elevated. Just like when we saw Srila Prabhupada in 1974, and my father asked Prabhupada, he said, "I'm not coming to this temple to see Krishna, I'm coming to see my daughter and son-in-law. Is that okay?" And Prabhupada, he was in a very jovial, casual mood, and he said, "Yes." He said, "They are loving Krishna." He said, "Chanting and dancing are symptoms of loving Krishna. So they are loving Krishna, and you are loving them. So two things equal to the same thing are equal to each other." So the principle is that if you get very attached to a Vaishnava, then ultimately you will become purified. That is Lord Shiva's business. Because he's always filled with devotion for Krishna. In one sense, you can say that Shiva and Krishna, Shiva and Vishnu are the same. Just like milk and yogurt are the same. You can't say that between milk and yogurt there's a difference. But yet there's a difference. If a recipe calls for milk, you can't substitute yogurt. In some recipes maybe, but not absolutely across the board. It's not going to work. And you can't turn the yogurt back into milk again. You can turn milk into yogurt, but you can't turn yogurt into milk. So there's some non-difference, but yet difference. Actually, should I say something that will confuse all of you? Yes? You want to be confused? Okay, fine. So, Many years ago, I was asked by the chief editor of Back to Godhead to write a series of articles on the 10 offenses. So I did that. So we've now published it on a book. In a book, it's on Amazon. It's called The Great Mantra for Mystic Meditation. So a series of articles about chanting the 10 offenses. And the one that was the hardest to write about was the second offense. So you might think, you know, that one took me a year and a half to write that article. So generally in our temples, when we recite the offenses on chanting, how do we say the second offense? To consider the names of demigods such as Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma to be equal to or independent of the holy name of Lord Vishnu. But it's not always said like that. It's not always translated like that. The Sanskrit is very ambiguous. So Sanatana Goswami, in his Brihadbhagavatamrita, translates that offense exactly the opposite. He said it's an offense to see any difference between the name of Lord Shiva and the name of Lord Vishnu. Now are you confused? I told you I was going to warn you before I said anything. Srila Prabhupada also in the second canto translates that offense as to see any difference between the different names of Lord Vishnu. To see a difference between one name of Vishnu and another name of Lord Vishnu. But then there's other places where it says 1,000 names of Vishnu are equal to 3 names of Rama, and 3 names of Rama are equal to 1 name of Vishnu. And then there's places where Bhaktivinoda Thakur says there's secondary names of God and there's primary names of God. So there you go. If you want the answer, you have to read the book. But in any case, Shiva and Vishnu are both, they're the same and yet they're not the same. So of course we call this a chintabheda-bheda tattva. It's inconceivable that Krishna is simultaneously one with and different from his energies. So with Vishnu and Krishna, they're simply the same. The only difference between Krishna and Vishnu is what? Rasa. The only difference is rasa. There's no difference in tattva. Tattva means ontological, what something is. So between Krishna and Vishnu, Ramchandra, they're all the same, tattva. But rasa is different. So different rasa, Krishna has different forms. But with Shiva and Vishnu, it's actually different tattva. Ontologically, there's a difference. But yet Krishna, in another sense, he's not different from everything. Why just Lord Shiva? He's not different even from each of us. Yes? That's what a chintabheda-bheda tattva means. He's not different from this table. Krishna is everything. Everything's Krishna. Yet everything's not Krishna. If you offer your food to the table, it's not the same as if you offer your food to the deity, although Krishna is the table. And Prabhupada would say things like, those who are bathing the deity and those who are washing the marble floor, it's the same. The service is counted the same. And it's called achincha. In other words, one cannot fully understand it just with the material brain. So we tend to, because the world is full of impersonalism, nirvisesha shunyavadi paspacha desha chanya, the Prabhupada's delivering the atheistic countries, which we generally take that to be the Western countries, but I don't know, even India's getting pretty atheistic, I think. Paspacha desha chanya, he's delivering the demoniac countries from nirvisesha shunyavadi, from impersonalism and voidism. And because the concepts of God today in the world are mostly impersonalistic, therefore, we very much stress the difference. Very much stressing, no, you're not God. God is God. You're the servant of God. You can never be God. But there's also the oneness. That is also true. We are not absolutely different from Krishna only. We are absolutely different from Krishna, and we are absolutely one with Krishna. But Lord Shiva, even though you can say everything is one with Krishna, still Lord Shiva is in a different category than the jivas. So Lord Shiva is in a category between the jivas and Vishnu. And even in the Bhagavatam, sometimes he's prayed to as if he's the same as Vishnu. I want to look at some nice stories about Lord Shiva. So the first story we're going to look at is the churning of the ocean of milk. So what's interesting about this story, one of the other stories that we're going to look at, is that even at the higher realms of the universe, there's fighting. Sometimes we think that we are going to make a society or a community where there's no politics and there's no fighting. Good luck. You know, even if you go all the way to the top echelons of the universe, you're going to find fighting, you're going to find discord. But what's interesting in this story is there was a temporary truce. It was a very temporary truce. It was a very self-serving truce. So the demigods had insulted Durvasa. Indra had received a garland from Durvasa, great sage, and he put it on his elephant. And the elephant is an elephant. So the elephant took the garland off and threw it on the ground and trampled it. He's an elephant. And Durvasa became very angry at Indra. You have no sense to take a gift I've given you and give it to an animal. So the demigods then became weak, and the demons of the universe conquered them. You know, the whole universe is being managed by higher celestial beings who are devotees of the Lord. Some of them are pure devotees, some of them are mixed devotees, but they're devotees of the Lord, and their aim, their desire, is to run the universe in such a way that everybody will be elevated. And there's also powerful living entities in the universe who want to control the universe for their own purposes. They want to exploit the universe, just like we have in human society. There's people who want to help others and run society for the benefit of others, and people who want to have power and control for their own selfish, exploitative purposes. So the way the universe works is, if you're a pious person, you get to have a powerful, wealthy, etc. situation. And way above any power and wealth you can get on this planet, you can get powerful bodies on other planets. And some of the entities who get those powerful bodies are atheistic. But the way the universe works, even if you're an atheist, even if you're an exploiter, if you're pious and you do good works, you can get a higher body. Krishna doesn't say, you know, I'm only going to give good things to the people that I like. There's laws in the universe, if you follow those laws. So there are beings in the universe, celestial beings who are devas or demigods, and then there's celestially powerful beings who are demons. So the demons were becoming very powerful and taking over the universe. So this is not the desire of the Lord. He doesn't mind giving atheistic and demoniac beings some power and money and etc. as reward for their good karma, but he doesn't want them exploiting others and running the universe. He wants the universe run by pious people. So the demigods went to Lord Vishnu and they said, please help us. And he said, you should temporarily declare a truce with the demons and tell them that you want to churn the ocean of milk. So on this planet there's salty oceans, but in other parts of the universe there's oceans of other substances. He said you should churn the ocean of milk and it will produce a nectar which will give you a very, very long life, practically like immortality, freedom from disease, bodily strength, so much. Like people today may buy some tonic or some vitamin or something like that to give them strength. But the tonic that's produced by the churning of the ocean of milk is far more powerful than that. So the demons said, sure, you know, we'll do this. The demigod said, we can't do this by ourselves, so we need your help. And then following the instructions of Vishnu, they took the Mandara Mountain. So Mandara Mountain is a huge mountain made of gold that exists on another planet of the universe. And the demigods and the demons were carrying this mountain. They uprooted the mountain. They were carrying it to the ocean of milk, but it was too heavy for them. And so it slipped, and then their bones got broken. Some of them died. And so the ones who had survived, they were crying to the Lord for help. So he appeared on the back of Garuda and just effortlessly, he cured everybody, brought them back to life and cured them, and then he effortlessly just put the mountain on the back of his own carrier, you know, so all these thousands of demigods and demons together combinedly couldn't carry it. And he likes to do that. And then Krishna likes to be a hero. I mean, every ordinary person, especially men, like to be heroes, yes? This is the nature of the Purusha. So Krishna being the supreme Purusha, he always likes to be a hero. So he carries the mountain on the bank of Garuda, and they bring it to the milk ocean, and they put the mountain in the milk ocean. Now, I don't think very many of us probably have experienced. Anyone here actually churn butter? Anyone actually churn butter? No. 3 or 4 people. So my daughter, who's lived in India for years, has made her own butter, but she doesn't use a churning rod. She just uses a food processor. Plugs it in and turns it on. You know, but people used to do it manually. So they'd have a churning rod, and it wouldn't take a long time. The bottom of it is kind of like a blender beater. You know, and you have a rope around it, and you pull the rope, and it separates the the butter from the buttermilk and solidifies the cream into butter. So that was the idea, and the mountain was going to be a churning rod. So if you have a churning rod, you have to have a churning rope. So what are they going to use for a rope? So they used Vasuki, who's a great celestial. I should warn all of you, these are all really fantastic stories. I mean, all the stories I'm going to tell, they're all cosmic stories. If you want to hear, like, more ordinary stories on the Earth planet, then you have to tell the pastimes of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That's much more relatable as far as our everyday experience. Yes? I mean, there's some miracles, like the Lord appearing in seven Sankirtan parties at once and things like that, but generally the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya are much more, you almost feel like you're reading about another ISKCON center someplace else. Yes? Actually, when I first read the Bhagavatam, I was really having a lot of trouble relating to the stories. Because I'm thinking, you know, I just don't know anybody who has flying spaceships. The people in the Bhagavatam didn't relate to anybody in my experience. I had a hard time thinking, okay, you know, what does this have to do with my life? And once I read Chaitanya Charitamrita, I'm like, yes. So these are all incredible stories of the cosmos. Of course, it's interesting that even in fiction, people make up these sort of stories. Isn't that a fact? So many movies and books about interplanetary wars and interplanetary fantastic things. Because we have an inner desire to hear about such things, and I'm sure somewhere in our memory, in our, you know, not so able to access memory, we can remember living on these other planets and being involved in some of these activities, etc. Because we all have lived on other planets in other bodies. This Earth planet is not our first birth in this material world. We've definitely lived on other planets, and we've had bodies and lives that were full of mystic power and all these sort of things that we're talking about. And one may say that, well, the reason we can't accept the scriptures is that they're full of all these fantastic stories. They're full of all these stories that are beyond our experience. An ocean of milk and a huge golden mountain that's being carried through outer space, being used as a churning rod and turning an ocean into, you know, churning an ocean, coming up with nectar, etc. You know, how can we believe all these things? But it's quite interesting that the rational scientists, the empiricists, who say everything has to be on the basis of our senses and logic, yes? And all you people who believe in scriptures, you're all fools. They say this, yes? Much propaganda like that. Is everything they tell us based on the senses and logic? So what do the scientists say is the beginning of the universe? When I used to run a school, I remember one of the people in the community gave us a video how the universe began. So my students immediately said, "Who took the video?" And they start off as if they know, right? And they start off saying that in the beginning it was a little bit of matter that was infinitely small and infinitely dense. My dear friends, is that supernatural? Can you have matter that's infinitely small and infinitely dense? No. That's supernatural. Immediately that's supernatural. And there was no time and space. So where is this infinitely small, infinitely dense thing? Where is it? Because there's no time and space. Then it explodes. That's pretty supernatural too. So first of all, there's no time and space, and then there's this infinitely small, infinitely dense particle. That's all very supernatural. Then it explodes. That's supernatural. Then when it explodes, it makes a universe. Has that ever happened to you? We had one devotee that made a radio show, and a radio show of different pastimes and different little skits, and one of it was a fake advertisement, you know, new construction company, put all the items in your lot, put all the wood and the glass and everything in your lot, and we bring dynamite and blow it up, and there's your house. No, so is that supernatural? Yes. What explosion creates order? Right? We're talking about blenders and churning. You have to put a bunch of stuff in your blender and leave the lid off. It doesn't create order. No? No, it doesn't. It creates disorder. So somehow this little chunk exploded and it created a sun. Why? I don't know. It just did. That sounds pretty supernatural. And it created planets that revolved around the sun perfectly. That's pretty supernatural. And galaxies and all these things that all have perfect timing. You know, you can decide 1,000 years from now when something's going to... That's pretty... How did that happen? Just chance. And then on this one planet, somehow or other, there was water. And there was just the right atmosphere. How? That's pretty supernatural. And then there was some electrical storm, and all of a sudden, some globs of mud became alive. That's pretty supernatural, too. And no one's been able to replicate that. You know, millions of scientists with their millions of brains and billions of dollars, they haven't been able to make a piece of mud become alive. They haven't been able to make one grain of rice. And believe me, they're motivated. I mean, not only would they get the Nobel Prize, but they'd become very rich. They can't make one seed. They can't even turn one kind of milk into another kind of milk. If they could turn cow's milk into human milk, they'd again become very wealthy. They're very motivated. They have thousands of scientists working tirelessly, day and night, to turn one kind of milk into another kind of milk. They can't do it. Am I correct? And they cannot produce one grain of rice with all their intelligence and all their money and all their equipment, and yet they want to tell us that it happened, just happened. And if we believe that, we're rational. And then that one little life form, it gradually, over billions of years, because of billions of mistakes, turned into giraffes and whales and sharks and coconut trees and people and... Do you ever make billions of mistakes and you end up with giraffes and coconut trees and, you know? Again, this is all supernatural. They don't have any evidence for it. It's just stories. It's just a bunch of stories. Oh, we'll get the evidence later. You know, and if you believe that, you're a rational being. And if you believe that there's celestial demigods and demons who are churning an ocean of milk with a mountain made of gold, then you're irrational. So my conclusion is that you cannot explain the origin of the universe without resorting to something that's fantastic. No one's been able to do it yet. No one's been able to come up with some explanation of the origin of life and the structure of the universe without resorting to things that are beyond our experience. And that cannot be proved just by some empirical method. Of course, you can see these things. I mean, not that each of us could. If you were an expert mystic yogi, you could go to other parts of the universe and see these things. I've had people who claim to do that. Of course, I can't test that any more than I can test when the scientists say how far Alpha Centauri is. I can't go out with my meter stick and check it out. But the point is, we are left with the situation, whether we like it or not, that if we want to explain the origin of things and we want to explain the structure of the universe, we end up with something that's fantastic and supernatural. And it really becomes a question. If you just say, I don't believe anything, but you can't live like that. You have to live as if you can't really live. An agnostic can't really live as an agnostic. Did you know that? Theoretically, you can have an agnostic philosophy, but you can't practically go through your daily life as an agnostic. You have to go through your daily life as if you believe that something is true. So we have to have some belief about the origin and meaning and structure of the universe. If we believe that this universe is just a bunch of chemicals and exploding chunks and random occurrences and billions of mistakes, then we're not really going to care so much about whether or not we're moral or ethical people, because morals and ethics is all just some human creation anyway. And we're not really going to care about whether we exploit others or we exploit the earth. Does this sound like what's happening on the planet today? Right, and we're going to be just fine with Darwin's theory of, you know, the survival of the fittest, and if I'm fitter than you, then I can exploit you and I can survive at your expense, and what's wrong with that? That's the way the world is. And then we wonder why a society who accepts this as truth is not a society of justice and fairness. It can't be. Their philosophy precludes it. You cannot have a philosophy like that and actually have a just, fair society. It just will not. So how we behave in life, or nor can you have an ecologically sane society, frankly. Why should you care? Why care? If all we are is machines, and if our existence is just chance,
if we're just a series of a billion mistakes after one freak electrical storm from some freak exploding chunk, who cares if we trash the planet and we're the last generation to live on it? What does it matter? It doesn't matter. Who cares if human beings exist or not? They're just a bunch of machines. So there's quite a tension between all their talk of caring for the planet and equality and their actual philosophy of life. Therefore, they can't do it. So if you've got to accept something fantastic anyway, if there's not an option, one that accepts something fantastic that'll bring you to spiritual ecstasy and love of God and actual equal vision and caring, that's how I look at it. All right, going back to our story. Just a little sideline for those of you who started thinking, what in the world is she talking about? So we have this, you know, they're thinking, I wonder when this class is over and I can leave. So what's more logical? To say somebody's driving cars or the cars drive themselves, you know? What's more childish? Anyway, so you have this golden mountain. It's in the ocean as a churning rod, and they have this huge snake. It's a huge celestial snake. I mean, it must be a long snake. And he's wrapped around the mountain, and Vishnu told Garuda to go away so that Suki would feel comfortable. And Vishnu and the demigods got by the head of the snake, and the demons were by the tail of the snake, but they weren't very happy, and Vishnu being in everyone's heart, right? In everyone's heart, so Krishna could tell, I'm sure even we couldn't tell by the body language of the demons, that they weren't very happy being at the tail. A materialist is always thinking about status. What's my status in relation to others, you know, so they weren't very happy. And so Lord Vishnu didn't say anything. He let go of the head of Vasuki and walked toward the tail. And the demigods just followed him. Whatever Vishnu does, we'll do. They didn't particularly care if they were at the head of the tail. The demons were like, yeah. You know, and they went over to the head. And they didn't realize that coming out of the heads of Vasuki was smoke and fire. And it was actually a favor to them that Vishnu had been having the head previously. So don't we do that, right? We look at our life and we say, I got the bad end of the deal. I want something else. And if we really insist on it, the Lord will say, okay. And once the demons got the head, they didn't want to complain. But they were covered with soot and smoke. Anyway, so they're churning and churning and churning and churning and churning. And the first thing that came out, and this had been warned, oh, we should back up a little bit. As they were churning, the mountain started to go into the ocean. You know, if you're churning yogurt or milk, there's a base to your churn. And so the churning rod also has a base, and the base of the churning rod is hitting the base of your churn. But the base of the milk ocean was very deep, and the mountain wasn't tall enough, so Mandara Mountain just started sinking into the ocean, so that the Lord himself came under the ocean as Kurma, and it says he's partially sleeping. He's in the form of a turtle, huge, huge turtle. He's partially sleeping, and his back was kind of itchy, and so he liked it that the mountain was scratching his back, and said that the Lord's ornaments are always polished. They always look polished because they've been polished by this churning of Mandara Hill. And this Kurma, as he's breathing under the water, it says that the tides are imitating this breathing of Kurma, who's the Lord of all rasa. He's facilitating the production of this nectar, a very beautiful Kurma. And then everybody's getting tired too, and so the Lord appeared on the top of the mountain, so in the thousand-handed form. So he's pulling on Vasuki, he's under the mountain, he's on top of the mountain, and he was enthusing everyone. He enthused Vasuki with ignorance, the demigods with goodness, and the demons with passion. Krishna enthuses us according to our desires. Anyways, they were churning, the first thing that came out was poison. So this often happens. We take up some endeavor, and the first thing that happens is difficulty. By the way, this also happens in our spiritual life. This is talked about in the 11th canto. That when, and we'll talk about this tonight, those of you who want to come all the way to Pretoria and hear me talk tonight about the process of chanting, which tonight we're going to give Krishna Lila. Since you said this was my last program in South Africa, I'm wondering if I'm not really going to make it to Pretoria.
So the plan, our plan is that we're going to be talking about how by chanting we reverse material creation through sound. We can reverse the whole creation, and we can reverse our own entanglement. And one of the verses we'll be looking at tonight is in the 11th canto, how when you put wood together, you first get smoke and then a spark, and then you pour ghee and then you get a blazing fire. And this is compared to the process of chanting. So first, when you're chanting, there's smoke. You become aware of your anarchas. You become aware of your entanglement in the world. So first there was this poison. And then everyone went to Vishnu. He said, no, go to Shiva. And they went to Shiva and they said, please save us. And Shiva's very kind. He's extremely kind. You said he takes care of the lowest people in the universe. So he drank all of the poison and kept it in his throat, from which his throat turned blue. Gosh, he shouldn't have to go ahead. So here we have Lord Shiva as Tripurari. So one of the leaders of the demons of the universe, Maya Dhanava, who's the leader of sorcerers, created three spaceships. One that looked like gold, one that looked like iron, and one that looked like silver. And sometimes I wonder about the stories and the movies of the Earth attacked by big alien spaceships, if again people are remembering somewhere and that there was actually an attack like that at one time in history. And Lord Shiva got out his arrows and he killed all the demons, and then Maya Dhanava created a lake of nectar and brought them all back to life and created the spaceships again, and they went back up. And then Lord Vishnu took the form of a cow and Brahma a calf and drank the lakes of nectar. And although Maya Dhanava is a demon and a sorcerer, he said nobody can interfere with the ultimate plan of the Lord. Then Lord Vishnu outfitted Lord Shiva with a chariot and arrows, and then he burned the flying cities of the demons to pieces. There was a great devotee of Lord Shiva called Banasura. He was the son of Bali Maharaj. He was the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj. He's the great grandson of Prahlad Maharaj. And he was a very, very pious person, although he was a devotee of Shiva, an atheist. And by his piety and his worship of Shiva, he became very opulent, and he had 1,000 arms. And when Shiva asked him, what benediction do you want? He said, please stay as my guard. Please guard my city. And Shiva said, fine. And the universal, great demons in the universe would come to see Banasura in his capital of Sunitapur. So Banasura had a daughter named Usha. And Usha one time had a dream that she was with the grandson of Krishna, Aniruddha. And in her dream, as she was sleeping, she called out, my beloved, where are you? And when she woke up, her friend who was there in the palace, Chitralekha, she said, who are you talking about? You haven't met any man yet. And she said, well, in my dream I met a man. And so Chitralekha was a great mystic. We were talking yesterday about the actual position of women in the Shastras. So it's not that all women were just simply domestic servants. Some of them were mystic yogis. So she was a mystic yogini. And she said, whoever this man is you're in love with, I can find him for you. Nice to have a friend like that, huh? They have all these signs everywhere. We'll find your lost lover, but I don't think they can actually do it. I mean, I haven't checked it out, but I don't think so. But Chitralekha could actually do that. She could actually do it. So she, and of course, they didn't know who it was. She just had this dream. They didn't even know his name. So Chitralekha could see anybody all over the universe. And she could draw Chitralekha's picture. She could draw very quickly. And she drew mystically pictures of every man in the universe. And she's showing them all. This must have been a lot of pictures. Hope she wasn't using a paper to do it. Anyway, she drew all these pictures. And Usha would look at them, you know, not that one. And then finally she got to Krishna. She said, oh, that looks interesting. And then she got to Prajumna, Krishna's son.
And she's like, ooh. Then she got to Aniruddha, Prajumna's son, and she that's him. And she sort of said, okay, I can get him for you. Must have felt like that, huh? And so she traveled, but by mystic power in outer space, and she went to Dwarka. Now, this is also really interesting, because in another story, when Mahavishnu wanted to steal the Brahmin's children, so it was hard to get into Dwarka, but Chitrayaka was able to get into Dwarka, and she was able to go into Aniruddha's palace, and without waking him up, she transported him by mystic power. And all of a sudden, he wakes up, and he's in Aniruddha's chambers. And the chambers were such that no man could even get in. They were very well guarded. And so because no man could even get in, nobody knew he was there, except the women who were inside. You know, I assume they had to order extra food and stuff, but anyway, nobody figured, there was no Sherlock Holmes to figure out, there's extra food being ordered. So he was there for quite some time. And he fell in love with Usha, and Usha fell in love with him. And after some time, the ladies who were guarding, they start to notice, you know, something funny's going on here. And it's not clear in the Bhagavatam what they noticed. Did they notice that Usha just had different sorts of behavior? Did they notice that she was pregnant? So it's not really clear. But anyway, they brought the message to Usha's father, Bhanasura. They said, your daughter's definitely having a relationship with a man. So they said, I don't think you should wait to see what happens. So Bhanasura comes into Usha's private quarters, and there he sees that she's playing dice with Aniruddha. And they were just very casual, like, hi, you know? And Bhanasura appreciated that Aniruddha, being the son of Cupid, Prajumna is the demigod of Cupid, so he was gorgeous, and he was kshatriya. He was obviously a worthy husband for his daughter, but he didn't like the fact, and who would like the fact, that Aniruddha had just come into the palace without his say-so and was already having an affair with his daughter. So maybe in modern society we don't get this so much, but you know, it wasn't that long ago when a father would have been very upset by something like this. So he goes to arrest Aniruddha, and Aniruddha is a prince. So he immediately goes to defend himself, he gets a club, and he looks like death personified, and he's fighting with the soldiers of Bhanasura. But Bhanasura, having been given opulences from Lord Shiva, he arrests Aniruddha, and Usha is crying. And Bhanasura doesn't care that Usha is crying, he arrests her boyfriend anyway. Meanwhile, back in Dwarka, everybody had woken up in the morning, and where was Aniruddha? Right? And it was the rainy season, they couldn't look for him. So after the rainy season, they're looking for him, they can't find him. And Narada Muni shows up and he tells them the whole story, how Aniruddha was kidnapped, how he's fallen in love with Usha, and how now Usha's father has arrested him. So the others were very angry, because it wasn't really Aniruddha's fault, was it? I don't think he was really responsible for this whole situation. And why should he be arrested? So the Yadus went to the kingdom of Samitapur to ask for Aniruddha back, and instead Bhanasura prepared to fight. So this is another cosmic battle. You know, and what's really interesting, because Shiva had promised, children voices are fine, so they're not crying. So, because Shiva had promised to protect Bhanasura, so Shiva and Krishna were fighting. Just imagine, right? And Prajumna's fighting with Kartikeya. I mean, there was the greatest personalities in the whole universe were having this battle. And Brahma, who doesn't get involved with fights, he's the big Brahmana in the universe. So he's just coming in and watching all this. And, of course, because Shiva is a great devotee of the Lord, and in one sense is not different from the Lord, it was the fight between Shiva and Krishna was very much on the sporting level. Like if you sit down with your family members and say, hey, let's play a game of Scrabble or something like that. You know, or you go to the tennis courts with your son and you have a game of tennis. So it wasn't with animosity. But every weapon that Lord Shiva came out with, then Krishna would counteract it. You know, Lord Shiva got a main weapon, and Krishna came out with a mountain weapon. So they were having fun like that, putting all these different... And Prabhupada says, you know, modern society, we only have fire weapons. But originally they had weapons of all the elements. They had earth weapons, and water weapons, and wind weapons. And then finally, Krishna released a yawning weapon. And the motion was too tired.
Fire.
And gradually, all of the army of Banasura was being decimated. And then Banasura got really upset, and he went to attack Krishna personally. But then one demigoddess that Banasura worshipped, Kotara, she saw that her devotee was in trouble. So she appeared before Krishna naked with loose hair, and he thought it not proper to look at her, so he turned away, and Banasura took advantage of that and left the battlefield. Then Banasura comes back, recoups his strength, and he comes back, remember he had 1,000 arms, and he's attacking Krishna with 500 bows and 2,000 arrows simultaneously. And Krishna just takes out his chakra and starts cutting off Banasura's arms. Then Shiva's giving out now. He's stopped his yawning. He's recovered from his tiredness, and he's come out with his weapons. And he brings out his Shivajwara. So Shivajwara is a great weapon of extreme heat. And it's basically everything is overcome by heat. And then Krishna sends his Narayanajwara, which is extreme cold. And the Shivajwara couldn't maintain his temperature, so he surrenders to Krishna. It's a beautiful prayer. And then Lord Krishna gives him protection. And then Lord Shiva comes and says to Krishna, you know, this Banasura is my devotee. Please don't kill him. And Krishna says, no, I will not kill any of the descendants of Prahlad. He can remain your immortal assistant. And then Banasura brings out Usha and Aniruddha with all pomp and ceremony and opulence, and they're brought back to Dwarka to be married. And anybody who remembers this pastime will never be defeated. So if anybody's poised to defeat you, you just remember this pastime and they will not defeat you. Seriously. Yeah. All right, then we have Vrikasura. So there was this one demon who wanted a great benediction, and he asked Narada, who should I worship? And Narada said, you should worship Shiva, because he thought this guy's never going to have the patience for bhakti. So now he was worshiping Shiva, but he made up his own worship process. Instead of offering water and gova leaves, he was cutting off pieces of his body and throwing them into the sacrificial fire. And after a few days, he got very impatient. This is the demons. Where is he? Where is Shiva anyway? And why isn't he coming? And he prepared to commit suicide, prepared to cut off his own head like a sacrificial animal and offer that into the fire. So you tell this guy was not very smart. Okay, first of all, he's doing an unauthorized process of worship. Second of all, if he cuts off his head and throws it into the fire, how is he going to see Shiva and get his benedictions? That's a terribly bright fellow. So it said that Lord Shiva then appeared just like any of us would. So if any of us saw somebody about to commit suicide, we would help them, even if we didn't know them, yes? It's just natural. So it wasn't Lord Shiva appeared because he was some great personality or because he was pleased with his concocted austerity, but just out of ordinary compassion. He said, please don't kill yourself. And he healed all of his wounds. And he said, what do you want? What do you want? I'll give you whatever you want. So Shiva often does that, just says, I'll give you whatever you want. Krishna does not do that. So please don't be disappointed. If you worship Krishna and you ask him for things and he doesn't give them, please don't be disappointed. Because Krishna's intelligent. I mean, not that Shiva's not intelligent, but Krishna really thinks, is this going to be good for you? You know? Whereas someone like Shiva is just, okay, whatever you want. So he said, well, I'd like a benediction that anybody whose head I touch will die. Of course, it wasn't, again, a very intelligent benediction, like that King Midas who said anything I touched would turn to gold, and then his daughter turned to gold, and his sandwich turned to gold, and he was really in bad shape. So the demon didn't think, you know, I'd never be able to touch anybody's head. It'd be a little awkward, right? He didn't think like that. But he thought, you know, and it was really interesting, Prabhupada says in the Krishna book, that he was thinking, I want to become immortal by killing everybody else. But, you know, really, materialists in general, that's how materialists think. Materialists think, I will become great by putting everybody else down. That's the whole root of envy, my dear friends. Whenever, I mean, I'm sure none of us do this, but if ever by chance we might happen to insult other people or put them down, even in our mind, or say something denigrating about somebody else. Generally, one's mentality is that way I look better. And it's just as foolish as thinking I'm going to live forever by killing everybody else. Because no matter how foolish everybody else is, you might be equally foolish. Correct? Yes? I don't become any better by envying and putting down and denigrating and insulting, etc., 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 whatever I do, to push down others. It doesn't actually push me up higher. So the same kind of mentality. So he went to touch the head of Lord Shiva. Prabhupada said he was thinking to steal Shiva's wife, Gauri. So this is the essence again of the materialistic person. I want to be the Lord of Maya. I want to have the material energy under my control. And it's interesting, Lord Shiva became frightened of his own benediction. And he started running all over the universe. And then he went to Svetadvipa, which is the Vaikuntha planet within this universe. And as Lord Vishnu saw him coming, Vishnu assumed the form of a Shiva Bhakta, Brahmachari. And he approached Rikasura, and he said, "Oh, son of Sakuni." And Rikasura thought, "Oh, he knows my father." And we have this tendency, this swajana, that if we think somebody is like myself, then we trust them. I've seen this when I travel, that if you are on the same plane with somebody, those people will help you out more than people who are on different planes. I don't know if any of you travel, have you ever noticed that? You get sort of a sense of belonging to the people who are in the same plane as you. Or if you're in a foreign country and you meet somebody from your own country, you get this immediate sense of kinship and trust with them. It's quite interesting. Or the part of your country. You know, if you meet somebody from your part of India or your part of South Africa and they speak your language with your accent, then you immediately feel, "Oh, this is somebody I can trust." Isn't that funny? We all do that. Swajna, someone who's like me. You know, this is the root of this whole thing of, you know, people who are my color and my ethnicity and my this and my that. I can trust them and everyone else is an other. So Vishnu took advantage of this tendency to say to Rikasura, "Oh, son of Shakuni," he thought, "Oh, someone who knows my family must be my friend." And then Lord Vishnu says to him, in the form of a brahmachari, he says, "You know, I see you're tired. You should take care of your body. You can only fulfill your material desires with your body." And Prabhupada said, "It's very easy to convince a demon of anything if you convince them about taking care of their body." So he said, "Okay, yes, I'll rest here." He said, "Tell me what's happened." Rikasura told the story. Lord Vishnu said, "Well, how can you trust Lord Shiva? He's in charge of ghosts and hobgoblins. Probably he didn't really keep it. Probably it's not a real benediction. You probably don't really have it." Again, this guy wasn't very smart, because he missed a little logic. He would have thought, then why was Shiva running away? You know, he didn't think like that. And then Vishnu says, "You know, why don't you test this benediction? And if it's not true, then you can kill Lord Shiva." But he was trying to kill Lord Shiva anyway. So it was, again, you know, that's the potency of Vishnu's words. Just, "Ah." And then he said, "Why don't you test it by touching your own head?" You know, if the demon was smart, he would have said, "Okay, I'll test it on your head." But instead, he said, "Oh, that's a good idea, you know." And that was the end of the demon. And then when Shiva appeared, because he was hiding, and then Lord Vishnu sort of very indirectly, very diplomatically told Lord Shiva, "Please don't give these sort of benedictions to these demons." Later he said that very directly to Lord Brahma about Hiranyakashipu. Now it's also said that if one meditates on this story, that one will not experience defeat. Okay, now the sacrifice of Daksha. So Daksha is the son of Lord Brahma. And he is very attached to fruitive activities, to enjoying this material world by the grace of Lord Vishnu. So he had a big sacrifice on a universal scale for that purpose. And Daksha, being the son of Lord, direct son of Lord Brahma, practically on the level of Lord Brahma, so very powerful person, one of the top most powerful personalities. Lord Brahma has, I think, 9 or 10 direct children. So very high level in the universe, and as soon as Daksha walked into the arena, his effulgence was everywhere. And everyone except for Lord Brahma, who's his father, and who was sitting on the asana as the director of the sacrifice, stood up to receive him. Oh, one other person didn't stand up. That was Lord Shiva. Now, Lord Shiva didn't stand up because he was in trance. And in trance, he was meditating on the Supersoul. And as he explained later to his wife, when one is meditating on the Supersoul, one is thereby showing respect, the ultimate respect to all living entities. But Doctor saw things materially, and he saw, Shiva is my son-in-law. He's married to my daughter. How dare he not stand up? How dare he not stand up? And Doctor started really blaspheming Lord Shiva, saying his heart is full of nasty things, and he's just dirty, and he's uncontrolled, and he's inauspicious, and terrible, terrible things. And then Daksha left the sacrifice. So then the followers of Lord Shiva, Shiva was just staying in trance, and the followers of Lord Shiva, they started cursing Daksha and his associates, that you're all just going to be fruitive workers, you're never going to achieve liberation. And then the associates of Daksha started cursing the associates of Lord Shiva. Anyone who follows Lord Shiva will become an atheist. You know, as I was going through this story again today, and I was thinking how this was not demons and demigods, like we're telling the first story of the churning the ocean of milk. These were all demigods. These were all demigods. I mean, they're not just devotees. These were the top, and they weren't even just the demigods. These were the top, top, top beings in the universe. And they're fighting. And they're cursing each other. And they're blaspheming each other. So we should be very careful. First of all, we should not be surprised. Many times people think, well, if I become a member of the Hare Krishna movement, everyone in the Hare Krishna movement will always be nice to everybody else all the time. So I'm going to warn you straight out, that's not going to happen. Just because I don't want you to think that that's going to happen and then you'll leave in disappointment. So there will be members who are sometimes not going to be nice to other members. And if it happens among the greatest controllers of the universe, why should we be surprised that it happens among humans in Kali Yuga? So first, we shouldn't be surprised to see such things happen. And second of all, we should not become party to it ourselves. So what did Shiva do when all this cursing and counter-cursing was going on? And the cursing is very deep and philosophical. We don't have time to get into it. But he left. He said, I'm not going to stay in a place where this is going on. So he left, and once he left, his associates also left. And Doctor also said Shiva should not be offered a share in the sacrifice. So then there was tension between Doctor and his son-in-law for a long time. And then later, there was going to be another sacrifice. And Shiva's wife saw in the sky all the airplanes of her sisters going to the sacrifice, and they were all, as women do, dressed up in their fancy clothes and jewelry to go to the sacrifice. And she saw all the demigods, everybody going to the sacrifice, and she said, I want to go too. She said, Shiva, I know that you as my husband, you're in the mode of detachment, but I want to enjoy the world in the social event. Now, actually, she wanted to go to see whether or not her husband was going to be respected. That was really her inner motive for going. And Lord Shiva said, please don't go. He said, don't go to a place where I'm being disrespected. She said, well, I can go even if I haven't been invited, because they're family. You can go to a family's house without an invitation. He said, but they don't respect me. And if you go, it will be equal to your death. It will be so painful for you. And she got very angry. So there's arguments even between Shiva and Sati again. So please don't think if I marry another devotee, we'll never fight. Even Shiva and Parvati sometimes fight. She got really angry. I mean, she was looking at her husband like, with fire practically coming out of her eyes. She was really, really angry. You won't let me go! And she's just pacing around the house. And finally she decides, well, I'm just going to go anyway. And so she did. And but Shiva's associates, he didn't know, but Shiva's associates, seeing her leaving by herself, they immediately went to serve her. So they brought a carrier, and they brought all the paraphernalia, and they went with her. So when she went to the sacrifice, her father ignored her. Her mother and her sisters greeted her, but her father ignored her, and everyone else ignored her out of fear of Daksha. So she wasn't very happy, and she didn't want to accept any presents from her mother and sisters. And then as the sacrifice starts, she sees that there's no oblations being made to her husband. So she became very angry. And she spoke up in the middle of the sacrifice. And she said, "You don't understand, my dear father, you don't understand that my husband is the most auspicious and that he actually is the well-wisher for all living entities. And he's created one of the greatest personalities in the universe." And she said, "If you hear blasphemy, then you have to leave the place, or you have to, you know, stop the other person, or you have to give up your life." And she said, "For me, I want to give up my life because my body is connected with you. And I feel that therefore I'm sharing in your blasphemy." So she put on saffron clothing and she performed mystic yoga, that she raised the life air from the Manipur chakra up to the Agya chakra. And then she meditated on the fire in the body, and she meditated on the lotus feet of Lord Shiva, and she gave up her life. So when she did that, the associates of Lord Shiva who'd come with her, and they started attacking the members of the sacrifice, and they started desecrating the sacrifice. And then Brigham Muni, seeing what was going on, he threw an oblation to the southern end of the fire, and all sorts of other entities came out, and they drove Lord Shiva's associates away. So the associates of Lord Shiva went back to their master, and they said, "Your wife has just committed suicide." So in great fury, and laughing like a madman, he took out a piece of hair and he dashed it to the ground, and he created this great monster who was like personified anger. And he said, "Go there with my associates and kill Daksha." So this great monster, he went to the arena with Shiva's associates, and there was nothing anybody could do, and they desecrated and destroyed everything and sacrificed. And finally, what they did was they knocked out the teeth of this one, Pusha, I think, who was laughing at Lord Shiva, knocked out the eyes of someone else who had been glaring at Lord Shiva, and then took Daksha, who was going to be head of it, but he couldn't even scratch his skin, because Daksha's a very powerful person. And he wasn't able to do anything. So finally he took the hatchet used for sacrificing animals, and with that he cut off Daksha's head, and he threw Daksha's head into the sacrificial fire. So this was a big disturbance. So again, these things happen in the material world. You know, and this is again, these things were happening among the demigods. There was not demons involved in this, really. You know, that we may think, "I'm going to do some great sacrifice, I'm going to do some great thing," and then there may be a problem even with other theistic people. So then the demigods went to Lord Brahma, and they approached Lord Shiva, and what's Lord Brahma? And Lord Brahma went to Lord Shiva. Brahma, of course, is the exponent, the father of Lord Shiva. And he said, "Please forgive everyone." And so Lord Shiva said, "All right." And he said, "What we can do is take the goat that was going to be sacrificed. We'll give that head to Daksha." And then Daksha, with the goat's head, apologized to Lord Shiva. And then there was another sacrifice at which Lord Vishnu appeared. And there's prayers and the Bhagavatam to Lord Vishnu by all the different members of the sacrifice, the different brahmanas and the priests and the different demigods, the women who were there and so forth. They're all saying prayers to Lord Vishnu. Of course, Daksha didn't really change his mentality, because the next life he took birth as a son of the Prachetas, and in the next life he offended Lord and offended Narada. So we said Lord Shiva was responsible for dissolution. So when the universe is meant to be destroyed, Lord Shiva does his Tandava Nitra, his dance of destruction. And that is his service to finally finish everything. It says in the Bhagavatam, when the Lord gets disgusted, "I've given the living entities this chance for spiritual realization, and they haven't taken it." And everything is destroyed. And then again, he becomes merciful and recreates everything. And then we also have when the Ganga was brought to earth by Bhagirath. Bhagirath did great austerities, and the Ganga said, "I'll come, but my force will be so great it will split the earth in two. Who's going to bear my force?" And then Bhagirath petitioned Lord Shiva, and he said that he would very gladly carry the Ganga on his head, and that is how Ganga came to earth. Shankara. hope you all enjoy that presentation. I hope they didn't go too long. Did I go too long? Was that okay? Okay. Do we have time for questions? Or should we have time for questions? We have your question sheet that gets passed around. I really like that. Okay, this is somewhat related. What is the position of the external energy Shakti in relation to the Lord? Does the Lord ever become subordinate to the external energy? No, never. External energy is always subordinate to the Lord. She stands behind him. The external energy is the Lord's sister, Vaishnavi. Why is Shiva depicted with animal skins? The sages would often wear animal skins so that snakes wouldn't bother them. Certain skins of the snakes wouldn't bother. And the significance of Shiva's snake, it's a representative of Anantasesha. So like Lord Vishnu buys on Anantasesha, so Lord Shiva is a representative of Anantasesha on his snake. Okay, this is not really related. It's a nice question, it's not related. I may come back to it. In the concept of Beta, more prominent should you focus on the oneness or difference with the Lord? Well, I see in the modern time, because of the influence of impersonalism, that Srila Prabhupada and modern acharyas put much more emphasis on the difference rather than the oneness. But we should not forget the oneness also. We are not propounding a philosophy of absolute difference with the Lord. Without oneness, there can't really be a relationship. You have to have something in common. Just like when people marry, they try to marry someone who's compatible. No, most people don't want to marry themselves. But you want to marry someone who's compatible. You want both oneness and differences. Is there any reference in scripture that Sankaracharya is an incarnation of Lord Shiva? Yes, but I don't know what it is from memory. I would have to look it up.
Prabhupada said it's in the Shiva Purana.
Shiva Purana, okay, thank you. Did you know the exact reference?
No.
No.
Prabhupada just said it's in the Shiva Purana.
Okay. There are, I think in the Chaitanya Charitamrita is given there. When Mahaprabhu is talking about Sankaracharya to the Mayavadis. This one I can't read. Good question. It is said that due to one's activities, one can move to upper or lower planets, but one has to come back to this world, as it's only through the human body that one can escape life-death cycle. Why can't demigod demon bodies offer this escape? They can. First of all, the demigod and demon bodies are also human forms. There's 400,000 human species, and that includes the forms of the demigods and the demons on the higher planets, and the demigods or the demons can certainly go back to Godhead from that body. They do not have to come back to the earth in order to go back to God. So, in fact, there's descriptions in the Bhagavatam that sometimes a yogi will go from one planet to another, and then get liberated along with Brahma at the end of the universe. Is it fair to say that if Krishna is ever present in our heart, he is, and is non-different from his material energy, then there should be no violence or suffering in this world. Suffering is an illusion. If you realize that, you will not be suffering anymore. Somebody else might look at your life and say you're suffering, but you will not be experiencing suffering. So yes, correct. If you realize the truth, material energy is illusion, that which is not. We're perceiving things differently than they are. It's very, 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 very much like you watch a movie and there's some suffering in the movie and you feel distress. And most of us have this experience. Sometimes you might feel distress for days afterwards thinking about the movie. Yes, but we have this experience. But is there actually any distress? No. There's no distress at all. By association, we feel distress. All distress, all suffering is due to association and attachment. If you drive by the road and there's a car accident or somebody you don't know, not that distressful, is it? But if it's somebody who's near and dear to you, and you see that they're lying on the side of the road from a car accident, the distress is very acute. So the distress is coming from attachment. So we feel pain and suffering in this body because we're attached to this body. It is entirely possible, even mechanically and materially, to go into a state of trance and not feel any pain from this body. Are you all aware of that? And anybody can do that. You don't have to be a spiritual person to do that. Anybody can do that. We don't want to stay in a state of detachment because we want to enjoy this body. Therefore, we experience suffering. Suffering is an illusion. Yes. And in another sense, as far as violence, I hope you guys understand this properly what I'm saying. There really isn't any violence either. You can't really hurt anybody. First of all, suffering is illusion. You can't really hurt anybody. Not possible. And even on the external level, you can only hurt somebody what they're destined to get. What the real harm of violence is you're hurting yourself. I mean, you can't really hurt yourself either in terms of your soul. But the reason that one is not supposed to be violent is that when you're violent towards others, you remove your ability to see truth, and you remove your ability to experience joy. Do you follow that? The fact that violence, that suffering is an illusion, doesn't condone violence. Because if you commit illusory violence within the illusion, it keeps you in the illusion, and it keeps you suffering. Do you all follow that logic? It's very esoteric. I hope you can follow that. Please explain further how Lord Shiva, although in material energy, is different from ordinary jivas. Because he's practically on the level of God. He's God dealing with the material energy. When God himself deals with the material energy, he's Shiva. Shiva doesn't become illusioned by the material energy like we do. He's in a completely different category. And when we pay obeisance to Lord Shiva without feeling like we are worshipping other gods. Shiva doesn't want to be worshipped as God. He wants to be regarded as a servant of God. He doesn't like being worshipped as God. So neither Shiva nor Vishnu or Krishna are happy if Shiva's worship is an independent God, because he's not. It's not his situation. How to be honest and patient with ourselves in our practice of bhakti? What do you want to be? Impatient and dishonest with yourself? How to tell if one is being lazy with oneself or if one is gradually taking to the process? Good to have other people in your life. Good to have a spiritual master. Or several. Good to have people in your life that you can go to and say, am I just making gradual process or am I lazy? And sometimes they'll say, you're just making gradual process, it's okay. And sometimes they'll say, you're lazy, get it together. So that's helpful. The analogy I always use is as a child learning to walk. How many of you here have watched a child learn to walk? Please raise your hands if you watched a child learn to walk. Okay. So it's a gradual process, and in the beginning they spend a lot of time not walking. They spend a lot of time falling, and children learning how to walk are often have bruises, yes? From falling and hitting things. But they keep going. How do you know that you're lazy? You don't keep going. You say, oh, it's too hard. The little child never says, oh, it's too hard. They never do that. And it's hard. Learning how to walk is not easy. It's not an instant, quick thing. But they never say it's too hard. And they're very forgiving of themselves for all of their falls and bumps and bruises. And they celebrate their successes. So the mentality, and Srila Prabhupada and Goswami compare the process of bhakti to learning to walk, that walking is inherent in the child. And they compare the process of sadhana bhakti to learning to walk. So my humble suggestion is please celebrate your successes, learn from your mistakes but don't dwell on them, and keep going forward. just exactly like the child learning how to walk, and one day you walk without it being a big deal.
Okay, there's one thing here we didn't talk about, which wasn't really related, but it's a good question, and we'll just answer very quickly. Prior to Srila Prabhupada distributing the Gita, how was it done? In other words, how did it come to be as it is today?
So I'm not sure if this refers to before Krishna spoke the Gita or just before Srila Prabhupada. Obviously, the Gita existed in Sanskrit. And there were many acharyas. Srila Prabhupada was not the first or the only acharya to explain Bhagavad Gita as it is. You know, of course, we have Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, so many acharyas. We're looking at Srila Prabhupada in the very modern day, and particularly in the English language, who is explaining Bhagavad Gita as it is. If you're going to talk about before Krishna spoke to Arjuna, so the same philosophy of Bhagavad Gita was spoken, obviously with some differences because it wasn't on the battle of Kurukshetra, but the same basic philosophy of Bhagavad Gita, as Krishna explains in the Gita himself, was spoken many times before. So thank you very much. Thank you for your hospitality here in Malaysia, Johannesburg.